welcome to Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. I'm your host today, Brandon Shea Mutella, also known as Bob McBobberson, the ultimate Canadian reporter name. Just call me Bob McBobberson.
What's your Halloween name, the Mutilator?
Oh, I like that.
That's clever.
Yeah, for Halloween on Twitter. I for a while there, I put insert Halloween nickname, and then I just like, I'll put the Mutilator. Brandon Shea, the Mutilator, Mutella.
The Mutilator.
Joining me, as always, is the ever-handsome Tom Caldwell.
Oh, shucks. I'm blushing.
Excellent.
Thank you for that. Welcome to another great episode of Good Evening. Looking forward to it. There's an inch of snow on the ground in Regina, but it's not going to last.
Yes, we did get snow. Also joining us, all the way from England, in the midst of war, Chris Haig.
Hello.
Our foreign correspondent.
I'm going to say, for once, the title is actually really appropriate. I'm there like, this is my episode.
This is it. Chris Haig, the movie.
My God, that is depressing. Oh my God.
I don't know, you get the cute lady in the end, even though her dad was a traitor.
Yeah. I mean, do we have to be so set on the lady part? But, you know, okay.
We're flexible.
Oh, you can have Huntley Haverstock.
I can be there like, oh yes, the beautiful woman. It's like, I'm pretty sure that's a muscle-bound man. Shut up, you know nothing. Oh look, there she is. Yeah.
Before we go into our discussion on the film that we're going to be talking about today, though, we've got a special little treat for you. Tom is going to introduce what we're talking about. And, you know, it's a little section that we'll be talking about today. Just, it's like kind of miniature, but it's just like this tiny, miniature special little report.
Not the real thing. So what we do a lot of social media and talking about Hitchcock online, and I found, and I'm sure this is not a surprise to a lot of our people that follow our show, it's davidminiatures.com. He is very present on Instagram and Facebook, and davidminiatures.com is his website. So I got hold of David, and he's a fascinating little company where he produces miniatures. Mm-hmm. They're not dioramas, but they're little models from movies. So David's 39 years old. He lives in Montreal, Canada, Go Canada, and he works out of his garage. He has a very professional shop where he builds these miniatures. He says in the past that he's attended different Comic-Cons and expos, and he used to just make something and sell a bunch of them, but now he really concentrates on bigger projects one at a time for clients. Mm-hmm. And for instance, we will put links online, but go and check out his website and have a look at this rear window piece that he did.
This is amazing.
I'm obsessed with this.
It's the view from the apartment looking into the courtyard, and I would love to see this thing in person. It's a very beautiful production. So this is a piece that he has produced as a commission for a collector. Now, the man wanted something special and unique for his wife's 40th birthday. She's a huge Hitchcock fan and a film fan. But originally it was going to be Rear Window or Breakfast at Tiffany's. Mm-hmm. So they emailed back and forth. They decided on Rear Window. And David was given a lot of freedom to decide what to produce. And it's a beautiful production. So what he does is he does the research. He watches the movie on the computer. He grabs still frames from the film. And then he draws blueprints to scale. He's a very meticulous artist. And it's really amazing work that he does. And he called this Rear Window one of his most challenging pieces for many reasons. It's a wraparound set. Mm-hmm. Six buildings with different sizes and styles of windows. It has three different levels. He figures roughly 150 to 200 hours of work on this piece. And the favorite feature of his is that Miss Torso has a room as part of the set. Mm-hmm. Quickly, though, there's a comment here from Bob Gale, the writer and producer of Back to the Future trilogy. He refers to David's dioramas are excellent on every level. Attention to detail, there's a wonderful tribute to the films. He smiles every time he sees them. David does a lot of his content as Back to the Future related. Mm-hmm. And he actually has recently done some work that is being charity auctioned for Michael J. Fox's Parkinson's Foundation.
Okay.
So he does some good charity work. So you guys have had a look at this, these photos. Doesn't that, wouldn't you love to have that in your collection of movie memorabilia?
You know, what I see here, like the attention to detail here is similar to what I've seen in a lot of videos that I come across on Facebook lately. Like, because I keep watching them, they keep popping up on my feed of people building things. And there's some really amazing, like, people do these kind of detailed train sets for, like, model trains. And that's what I'm seeing here. Like, the grass detail, like, all of this stuff looks real. It looks like real grass, looks like real trees, real buildings, real bricks and all this, but it's, like, really, really small. Like, the scale that he says here is it's 1 to 87 scale. It's 1/87 scale. But yeah, like, this is the whole courtyard that you see in Rear Window, and it's just beautiful. There's lights inside, there's little pianos inside of the rooms, and things like this. Like, I've only seen Rear Window once, and it's been quite a while since I've seen it, but, like, even just seeing here, I remember some of this stuff from the movie. You know, I remember him looking out and seeing these people here. And it's really, really stunning work. But he's done some other great stuff in here, too. Like, you definitely got to check his website out when you get to it. Like, there's Johnny Five from Short Circuit in here. There's a bunch of Back to the Future stuff, as you said. But there's tons of different kinds of dioramas. Ghostbusters, Jurassic Park, things like that. That's all in here. Another one of my favorites, because I'm such a big fan of it, is this one he's got on Edward Scissorhands.
Yeah.
I love Edward Scissorhands. Like, that's one of my favorite movies. And he's got the pastel houses in the hill with Edward Scissorhands' house on top of it. So, yeah, there's some really, really stunning stuff. But he does people, too. Like, this Jason Voorhees. Oh, my goodness. So, yeah, there's some really, really great stuff in here. You got to check his website out. And I guess you just email him and tell him what you want, and he'll come up with something for you.
Yeah, like, you can work remotely and he'll make you a one-of-a-kind piece. He says how a lot of his clients are the high-end collectors. They want to display these things in their home or their office. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the collectors know that there's value in knowing it's a one-of-a-kind production. Like, nobody else would own one of these pieces of art. And he says how after he finishes a piece, he feels great. You look at it, you become the viewer. He stares at it in the details, but he realizes it is not his own, really. Like, he doesn't own it anymore. He takes the photos and videos, ships it off to the client, and he says some of the pieces are harder to let go than others. And
I bet.
200 hours to build that. Chris, have you got room in your new apartment for something like this?
No. I love this. I've been staring at the details, and I think in theory it takes place before the events of the film, or kind of at the very start. But I just love it. I think it's so cool. I love all the little details, because I'm not the person who can do real attention to detail. I'm nowhere near skilled enough and all that sort of thing. But it's like,
I would not have the patience to make.
Oh, but it's like, there's the tiny dog in the basket. There's, you know. You know, the sculptor on the ground floor flat and her stuff. There's every, you know, the grass looks real. It just, David's miniatures is so incredible, this level of detail. You can see why it was such a big project, because, like he said, you know, there's different buildings, there's different textures, there's different designs, because it's not like a straight up and down kind of skyscraper. It's, you know, a courtyard.
It's a three-dimensional. And he's really doing what Hitchcock did. Like, when Hitchcock produced Rear Window, they built this courtyard in a soundstage. Mm. He's doing it smaller, better, later as a tribute. Yeah. So good for him. Mm-hmm. Thank you for David for talking to the show. And like I was saying, go check out his social media and
the website.
Some fascinating work there.
DavidMiniatures.com.
Can you imagine if he sent us a free one?
Yeah. Mm. It would. I would want to. A diorama of my desk with my computers and all my Hitchcock toys.
At the films we covered, what would you do? So, like, I would love the Rebecca's Bedroom from Rebecca. I think that'd be a goodness. Cool one.
The Psycho, the mom's bedroom from Psycho. I don't think I could sleep knowing that existed in my house. I'd have to keep it in the garage.
I would want the train. Like, when the train has stopped in the Lady Vanishes, and they've got like the guys outside shooting in, like with trees and stuff.
Oh, see, so yeah, you'd have like the like length of the train as well, and it's the grass and the sand, and there's little Nazis and Nazis.
Or even super meta would be the little kind of whatever it is, like the Swedish town or whatever that they're in at the beginning, because that was actually a miniature.
It's a miniature of a miniature. Right?
So do the miniature of the miniature town.
Maybe they could just open the crates at the studio and just give you the miniature? I don't know.
Sure, that'd be fine. No, if he can do that,
that was fun.
I just said 39 cents, but I meant Lady Vanishes, yeah. So the beginning of that is the miniature town that they had to put the camera through. So,
hey, Brandon.
Yes?
What's our favorite nickname for our buddy Chris over in England?
Foreign correspondent.
Because he lives in
a different
country.
Like, that's the polite one that I can say on air. I mean, what about other ones?
We've always had fun on our show with referring to Chris is our foreign correspondent, which is a loving term. We also have, of course, Pat McFadden, our man who knows exactly enough, our associate producer. And you don't want to know what Brandon and I call each other. Mm-hmm. But that's our movie for today, is Foreign Correspondent. And
I call Tom Betty Boop behind the scenes.
Anyway, it's a really cool film. I really enjoyed this. So taking from Peter Aykroyd's Alfred Hitchcock book, one of my favorite resource materials. An American reporter is sent to London, where he promptly falls in love with the heroine. The girl in question, however, is the daughter of a prominent peace campaigner who turns out to be the chief of the enemy spy ring in England.
Awesome. I love it. This was such a fun movie. Okay, let's jump into our trivia on it. I'd like some feedback from the listeners on what they think of the trivia. There's times when I feel like it's a little bit too long. So if the listeners could tell me, I've kind of pulled it back a little bit for this one, I think, cause it does seem to kind of go on a long time. And it is a lot of like old movies and stuff that these people are in that I talk about. So I've kind of trimmed it down a little bit here. So tell me if you like the shortened one a little bit here. Foreign Correspondent actually had a couple of different names that it was released by across the world. Some other titles were Imposter and Personal History. So it's a 1940 spy thriller from Hitchcock. And it had a release date of August 16th, 1940. Now, in 1941, Foreign Correspondent was nominated for 6 Academy Awards, but it did not win any. It was nominated for Best Picture alongside of Rebecca. So that's pretty amazing that Hitchcock had 2 pictures nominated at the same time for Best Picture. I'm sure this has happened a few other times, but the only other time that I can think of off the top of my head is in 2000 when Steven Soderbergh was nominated for Traffic and Aaron Brockovich. So I don't know if it's happened other times, but that's the only other one I can think of on my head. Send me a tweet or something like that if you can think of something else. It was also nominated for Best Original Screenplay, Best Actor in a Supporting Role for Albert Basserman, Best Cinematography in Black and White by Rudolf Mette, Best Art Direction for Black and White, Alexander Golitzin, and Best Effects and Special Effects by Paul Eagler and Thomas T. Moulton. Foreign Correspondent was named one of the 10 best films of 1940 by Film Daily and was nominated for the Best Picture by the National Board of Review. Producer Walter Wagner bought the rights to journalist Vincent Sheen's memoir, Personal History, in 1935, but after several adaptations proved unsatisfactory, Wagner allowed the story to stray significantly from the book. It took numerous writers and 5 years before Wagner had a script that he was satisfied with, by which time Hitchcock was in the United States under contract with David O. Selznick and available to direct this film out on loan. So he actually did it for another studio. So Hitchcock did the work and he got paid for it, but David O. Selznick actually got paid first and then paid Hitchcock out of that money. So he kind of subletted him out to make this film with another company. Hitchcock, who enjoyed not working under the usual close scrutiny of Selznick, originally wanted Gary Cooper and Joan Fontaine for the lead roles. But Cooper was not interested in doing a thriller at the time, and Selznick would not loan out Fontaine. Later, Cooper admitted to Hitchcock that he had made a mistake in turning down the film. So for main actors, we've got Joel McRae, who was born November 5th, 1905. He played Johnny Jones, Huntley Haverstock, and he was an American actor whose career spanned almost five decades and appeared in over 100 films. In addition to Foreign Correspondent, some other films that he was in were Preston Sturges' classic comedy Sullivan's Travels, The Palm Beach Story, Bird of Paradise, The Most Dangerous Game, which is what I know him best for, which is a really cool short film, Bed of Roses, and The More the Merrier. He also played Wyatt Earp in Sam Peckinpah's Ride the High Country opposite Randolph Scott. With the exception of the British thriller film Rough Shoot in 1953, McRae appeared in Western films exclusively from 1946 until he retired in 1976. This is his only Hitchcock appearance. George Henry Sanders played Scott Folliott, and we spoke about him when we did Rebecca. This will be his last Hitchcock appearance. Lorraine Day was born October 13, 1920, as La Rain Johnson. She played Carol Fisher, and she was an American actress, radio, and television commentator, and former MGM contract star. As a leading lady, she was paired opposite major film stars including Lana Turner, Cary Grant, Ronald Reagan, Kirk Douglas, and John Wayne. As well as having had numerous film and television roles, she acted on stage, conducted her own radio and television shows, and wrote two books. This is her only Hitchcock film appearance, but she will be in the Alfred Hitchcock Hour episode, Death and the Joyful Woman. Herbert Marshall played Stephen Fisher, and we spoke about him when we covered Murder. This is his final Hitchcock film appearance, but he will also be in Alfred Hitchcock Presents episodes A Bottle of Wine and Little White Frock. And an interesting note, he also did the radio adaptation for The Lodger, which was done by a production called Suspense. He did the CBS Philip Morris Playhouse episode of Rebecca for radio. Also for Suspense, he did the 39 Steps. And for Lux Radio Theater, he did The Birds. So he's done some Hitchcock adaptations on radio. And Albert Baserman was born the 7th of September, 1867, and he was a German stage and screen actor. He was considered to be one of the greatest German-speaking actors of his generation and received the famous Iffland Ring. He was married to Elsa Baserman, with whom he frequently performed. And Albert Baserman, who played Van Meer, he did not speak English, so he had to learn all of his lines phonetically for this film. This was his only Hitchcock appearance. Now, Hitchcock's cameo can be seen when Joel McRae first spots Van Meer on the street in London. Hitchcock walks past him while reading a paper. And one other really fascinating thing that I found when I was doing the research for this film is that there was a 1940 film called The House Across the Bay, which was directed by Archie Mayo. It starred George Raft and Joan Bennett and was released by United Artists. In 1939, it was reported that Warner Brothers were considering buying it as a vehicle for James Cagney and Marlene Dietrich, but they could not come to an agreement, and Walter Wagner bought the rights. Now, Wagner made the film as part of what was meant to be a slate of six films for United Artists, and filming on that film, The House Across the Bay, was pushed back so that Wagner could make Foreign Correspondent. Some scenes of the characters Pigeon and Bennett in an airplane were actually filmed by Hitchcock as a favor to Wagner. And this would have been done while he was directing Foreign Correspondent at the same time. So I haven't seen The House Across the Bay, but I'm guessing that these airplane scenes would have utilized the set that was used in the climax of this film. So if I'm wrong on that, somebody please send me a tweet because I haven't seen the movie, but that's some interesting information I had never heard of, that Hitchcock did a favor for Wagner and did some extra directing for this weird film called The House Across the Bay. And those are my trivia notes for the film. So let's jump into the discussion of this film. So yeah, Best Picture nominee, 1940 as well. The first thing I want to talk about, I think is really fascinating, is that this film was made before war was announced. And it came out after war was announced because of production.
So it's contemporary. Like, it's right in the middle of the action for real-world events.
Mm-hmm. And an interesting kind of legend about this movie is that Hitler and Germany are apparently never mentioned in the film. Like, that's a legend that goes around about this movie. but it's also not true, because both Hitler and Germany are mentioned as, like, the people in here. Like, when Huntley Haverstock is given his name, he's like, well, maybe I can try and talk to Hitler. And right at the end, they say war with Germany has started. So I don't know where this myth and legend has come from that they're not said in the movie, but they are, which is weird.
There's a line from François Truffaut talking to Hitchcock where he says, it has been said that Dr. Gables enjoyed foreign correspondent very much.
I've heard that.
So this is, you know, we talk about World War II and Nazi history. Mm-hmm. This is in the thick of it. Like, this is really, really involved in what was happening in the big picture at the time. That's pretty amazing.
So we've got another MacGuffin here of this clause. And so in my personal headcanon, we've now got ourselves an Alfred Hitchcock universe, and this is the same clause that was whistled about in The Lady Vanishes. What do you think?
It's the, what is clause 27? The secret clause that if he tells it out loud, it will help them win, it'll help them make war. Mm-hmm. And this is Van Meer is part of this. He signed the pact and he knows what the clause is. So they, throughout the film, they're trying to get Van Meer to tell him what's this clause.
Right.
And we hear about 10 words of it.
Right.
In the event of war. And then he gets cut off.
Okay.
So that's a MacGuffin, but it doesn't exist. But that's integral to the story.
Right. Now, the idea of the MacGuffin is it's supposed to be something, it really doesn't matter what it is, but it's something that's designed to push forward the plot of the movie. However, I actually do have a big problem with this MacGuffin in this movie. And the problem is that two people know about this secret clause that hasn't been written down. If one of these people gets run over by a bus, this clause is null and void and nobody knows about it. So what the heck is the importance of this clause if as soon as one of these people's dead, the clause doesn't even exist anymore?
But that's suspension of disbelief. That's giving the film the privilege of having something that doesn't make perfect sense in the real world to allow the film to move forward, right?
Yeah. I don't think there's any other MacGuffin in any other Hitchcock film that I have a problem with like I have with this one. It doesn't detract from my enjoyment of the film, but afterwards when I stop and think about it, I'm like, this is really kind of ridiculous because...
So it's just so implausible that there would be a secret clause that only two people knew by memory that you just cannot allow that to happen.
For me.
Yeah.
That it would have that much of effect when only two people know about it and it's secret. I don't know. Like, to me, that's just... it's a small thing to get hung up on, and that's kind of why I wanted to bring it up early. Chris, what do you think?
I'll be honest, I'm still hung up on the idea that this and Lady Vanishes are connected. I was just going through it in my head. I'm like, yeah. Because they never say it out loud. It's all... It's in terms of a song.
And it's a secret. The whistle's a secret clause. The tune is a secret clause. So even there, I don't have a problem with
like,
that.
If it was like 22 or something, like clause 20, like it's a whole bunch of clauses.
Yeah.
That it just becomes like the Hitch verse or something.
The Hitch verse.
Yeah, but rather than the cop verse.
Universe. Because like when you get into somebody like Quentin Tarantino, like there's like a Quentin Tarantino movie universe, and then within that there's like a movie universe within Quentin Tarantino where the movies take place in the same universe.
Yeah.
Like when you get into it.
Yeah,
right?
Like Kill Bill is a fictional movie in a fictional universe that
he's
created, and it's supposed to be Mia Wallace and all that sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Anywho, we can move past it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of room in this rabbit hole.
So we can move on. I just wanted to point it out that to me, that's the only thing that doesn't work in the film. It's the most bizarre MacGuffin ever.
This film is a true spy drama.
Yes.
With a lot of comedy thrown in, and it's light and quick moving and entertaining. There's enough twists in this that you could compare it to a bag of licorice you might have in the movie theater. Mm-hmm. There's a really good line that Huntley says at one point to kind of sums up what's happening. So just to kind of reiterate, Huntley Haverstock is Mr. Jones, who is a New York Globe reporter who messed up in New York City. He assaulted somebody. So his editor from the newspaper sends him overseas kind of like as a punishment to get him out of the way. And this kind of comes across originally as a bit of a lark. You know, this will be... a fun assignment. I don't really have to work that hard. But he very quickly uncovers this big conspiracy. Mm-hmm. Now, Huntley says, I seem to know too much. I don't know the ins and outs of your crackpot peace movement. I don't know what's wrong with Europe, but I do know a story when I see one. I'll keep after it until it gets... I get the story or the story gets me. Mm-hmm. And good for him. Like, he's over there. He could be sitting on his, you know, butt, just sort of taking his expense account. But he uncovers very quickly a very big story.
Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't punishment that sent him to Europe. The owner of the paper liked that he punched the cop in pursuit of the story. And that's why he's like, this is the kind of guy we need. So it wasn't done as punishment. It was done because they liked his thing. He thought he was going to get punished, so he's about to quit.
Right.
Instead. But, yeah, like, there's some really fascinating stuff. Like, Hitchcock's always got those things that are very Hitchcock. And in this one here, it's the windmills, right? He always picks this really unique visual piece that almost like sums up what the movie is. And here it's the windmills. Now, what's really fascinating about the production of this, so I watched the Criterion Blu-ray. So I checked out the bonus features. So again, a lot like what he did with Rebecca is some matte shots. So he would film on the road and like most of the film would be matted out. And then they created a matte painting of the windmills, and the painting itself had a windmill arm that turned on the front of it. So it was a composite
shot. It was a
shot.
Physical moving arm front, like a fan.
Yeah, on a painting.
Wow.
And they filmed that separate from the cars and stuff. So yeah, so it's a composition of two different types of shots. So he really goes out of his way to make it. But then also, these wonderful, wonderful set designs. The interior of that windmill is probably the greatest thing I've seen in a Hitchcock movie so far. Yeah. That we've
there's
done
your there's your David Miniatures project right there, the interior of the windmill.
I love it. Oh, my goodness. It is so beautiful, and the detail in it, the way that those steps go up. He got so many amazing shots looking down, looking up, you know, like looking around corners. The tension in that scene was so crazy because, again, they're looking down and he's trying not to get seen. They're bringing Van Meer's out, but he's stuck on the stairs because if he goes down, the one guy will see him. He can't go up because they're right there at the top of the stairs. Oh my goodness, like that whole scene is spot on. One of the best things I've seen in Hitchcock film so far.
And you know, the minute you get inside a windmill, which, pardon my ignorance, I believe would have been a flour grinding mill.
Yeah, I was thinking something. That
like
too.
It's not a power product. Like nowadays, you drive around, you see a windmill, they're collecting hydroelectricity. But I think this windmill would have been for grinding flour or something very practical.
Mm-hmm, probably.
And you're thinking, look at all those open gears and all these levers. Like that's a very physically dangerous environment, and it pays off like right away. That there's a scene where Huntley's trench coat gets pulled into the gears, and he could have. Either got killed by the gears, like he could have got pulled into the mechanism, or he could have got revealed to the bad guys he was hiding from and got shot, right? Mm-hmm. Hitchcock likes to show you the danger, let you realize the danger, and let you watch what happens. We know that his trench coat is caught in the windmill gears. What's going to happen? Is he going to get, you know, injured or killed because of this?
Yeah, his arm could get ripped off, basically.
I love that windmill set. It's... Mm-hmm. And you've got to... the production value across the whole film is fantastic in the sense of, you know, take the wind... It's kind of like there's two major points of it throughout the film, one of which is the plane sequence, second of which happens earlier, is the windmill, and I just love it because it's... For me, it's Frankenstein.
Okay.
Which I don't know if you're aware of. So, like, you know, the end of Frankenstein where, you know, the confrontation's in this kind of windmill and, you know, there's fire and it's explosions and destruction and all that sort of thing. And I looked up that and it was so gothic. And I loved the mechanism. And like you were saying with the shots and everything, and it's stuff that you'd see repeating or get channeled, I suppose, in stuff like Vertigo with all the dolly zooms and with all these kind of just gorgeous shots. And, you know, Tom is completely right when he says, oh, well, this, you know, when the trench coat gets caught, it's kind of a, it's a double threat, because it's not as simple as, oh, there's a bad guy coming up with a gun. It's your coat stuck, so either, you know, if you don't get out of it, you're either going to get crushed, or a bad guy's going to notice and kill you. So it's that extra, it's kind of like an extra layer of suspense, and that is what he's really, you know, good at. It's not just a bomb, you know, there's something else going on. So, like, you know, you can set a bomb off under a table, or plant a bomb under a table, confront the bad guy, and he says, well, you know, we've got your wife and kids. So then it's like, what, you know, what's going to happen? If he dies, does that mean that the, you know, the wife and child are going to die? If he doesn't let the bomb go off, does that mean he's... It's this kind of complex thing that's going on. And I just, I enjoyed this film a lot more than I thought it was going to. I'm not a big war film person. I have to really be in the mood for it. But this, I found really engaging. And I thought it was just really smartly handled.
We're talking about the master of filmmaking and the amount of work and the amount of money. This was a $1.5 million production in 1940. So that's a huge, that's a monster budget for the day, right?
But it was well received, but it did actually lose money. I was looking into it. It lost like $300,000 at the theaters, right? But I mean, like, it's just because the budget was so big. Like, that was a pretty hefty budget for the time.
So again, borrowing from Peter Ackroyd's book, he talks about the energy and inventiveness in the film. The scene where the statesman is apparently assassinated in the public square in Amsterdam. Now, this is a beautiful scene with hundreds of black umbrellas in a heavy pouring rain. Now, filmmakers don't just go out and say, hey, it's going to rain Tuesday morning, let's shoot in the rain. They have to be able to control everything that happens. Mm-hmm. Hitchcock arranged for the building of a facsimile set on a 10-acre build. The Colorado River had to be diverted and a sewer system built to provide this amount of endless rain for this scene. So that's a pretty amazing bit of effort for the sake of the film. And what purpose does the rain serve, right? Like, when we're watching this film and there's this gathering on the steps of this building and what appears to be an assassination of this person, why is it raining? What good does that do? Is that symbolic? Like, what is the purpose behind having this torrential rain happening in that scene? Why can't it be a hot, sunny day?
See, I was always under the impression that he did it to hide that he couldn't get the enough extras, right? Because the umbrellas fill up the screen, right? And then it also does provide a really interesting shot of when he escapes. But for sure, diverting a river would cost more than hiring a few extra extras, right?
Well, and it is a beautiful sort of sequence when the assassin who poses as a press photographer, he has his big clunky camera with the one light bulb, you know, and he has the pistol, and he does the assassination. He shoots the gun, and he runs through the crowd of trench-coated people and gets lost in the sea of black umbrellas. So Hitchcock is going out of his way for the visuals, the artwork. Like, he's painting with a brush on the screen. It's a very, very impressive scene.
Yeah, I mean, it also does help serve the story, then, because it makes it, it fits a logical purpose then as well, in that he's able to escape through this kind of sea of trench coats, all that sort of thing. And the rain coming down, he is painting in aesthetics. And for me, you know, it's kind of very film noir. You know, it is that kind of hard-boiled thriller aspect to it. And it is, you know, this is a spy film, it is a war film, all that sort of thing. And, you know, I know both of you mentioned, oh, it's quite light on its feet and, you know, it's quite comedy and that sort of thing. But I thought it had some real dark moments in it, you know, some of which we'll talk about in a bit, but it's a very well-balanced in terms of, oh yeah, there's comedy and there's, you know, light emotes, that sort of thing, but then it never, how do I put it, it's like it never loses sight of the fact that this is a film. Even though it's a speculative fantasy, it's concerning stuff that actual people are going through. So like the epilogue at the end, which wasn't originally intended, it got added on at the end. It's really kind of rams home.
You're talking about the radio speech at the end?
The radio speech at the end, yeah, and it really, this whole kind of duality thing of, like, dark and light, it's even mentioned in you know, as the darkness kind of closes in on them, you know, the last words are kind of keep the lights going, or kind of keep it going, keep the home fires burning, to quote kind of World War II propaganda, that sort of thing. So
Hitchcock took a lot of abuse at the time for abandoning England, for not being involved in the war effort, and for going to America and producing films. But I think he defended himself by bringing up the fact that this was a patriotic film, and it did serve a bit of keep the home fires burning propaganda, pro, you know, encouraging the to be quick about it, the American viewers, to support the war effort. They talk about they're listening to In America, Johnny at the end when he's making his patriotic speech on the radio from England. They actually play the Star Spangled Banner at the end. It at the very last 5 minutes, you would swear this was a government propaganda film, which is not such a bad thing, because in the time when the people were watching this, the war was happening. Brandon, you said the release was a little bit into World War II, like it wasn't quite.
Let me just double check here. I closed my notes already, but yeah, it was 1940 that it came out. And opening my notes, it says, I don't know when was World War II, was the end of 1939, wasn't it, that it started?
Yeah, right. first so September.
August 16th, 1940 is when this came out.
So this isn't just a Hollywood piece of entertainment. It is also a patriotic effort. It is also a pro-America, pro-Allied forces propaganda film in a good way, but it very cleverly disguised in a sense as an entertaining film. So it'd probably have more reach and more effect and more interest than if you were the American viewer sitting in the theaters and watching propaganda films. You might be kind of like, oh, I don't really want to listen to government propaganda. But this is a clever way to get the message across to the masses.
I was going to ask you guys about this because, taken out of context, like if people don't know what's going on at the time of this film's release, I wonder how they interpret this end, because, you know, like as a Canadian, and I've mentioned this on a few other podcasts of mine, now none of us are Americans, but I do have a problem with some American cinema when they do this rah-rah USA thing in their movies, right? Like two examples that I can think of that I've talked about recently are like the end of Man of Steel. Right when Superman comes to talk to that guy, and that military leader's like, how do I know you're not going to attack America? And it's like, you know, Superman is like this global hero, yet the movie at the end is like, we have to protect America. And then the other one that I recently talked about on my podcast, Franchise Fatigue, was Terminator 3. And right at the beginning of Terminator 3, when they show old John Connor, they've got this ratty, destroyed USA flag that they've got behind them. And it's like, Judgment Day is not an American thing. Why do we need all this American rah-rah propaganda in these movies when that's not what they're about? But this is different. And like, so at this time when this movie is made, you know, like America, like wasn't in the war, right? And it was like talking about like America has to stand up for something bigger that's going on in the world right now. And they talk about like keep the lights burning, like support people, support what they're fighting for, which is peace. They're fighting to have peace in the world, kind of thing, which is like a oxymoron, but it makes sense. You know what I mean?
I think it just makes sense that how could a film of this era not have a connection to the war and being pro, you know, I don't know. I guess we're kind of, again, I'm not a history guy. I'm not a history major. I'm not really well versed or well spoken on that whole area, but it didn't bother me. Like it made it very authentic to me, and it made it that much more of an interesting film.
Cause like the States didn't enter the war until the bombing of Pearl Harbor, right? Which was December 7th, 1941. So that's like more than a year after this movie came out. And I mean, we've got this American naval captain who's, and they talk about it in the film where they're like, look, we have to stay out of this. Right? Like, which was the stance at the time. We've got to stay out of what's going on in Europe. And it wasn't until the bombing of Pearl Harbor that pulled the States into the war. So, which is a statement unto itself where they're like, look, you have to get involved. Right? And that's all. That's what this film is saying, is that we have to get involved with what's going on here.
So could this film perhaps have actually influenced world history?
No. Because that was well over a year before the States was pulled in. This is, you know, it took a direct assault on U.S. soil for them to get pulled into the battle.
No, that's exactly, I mean, and it's kind of something that relates to British cinema in the sense of, during this time, a lot of the films were... It's weird, if you talk to kind of people at World War II, particularly of certain generations in the UK, there are still a lot of attitudes that are very... how do I describe it? Basically, there's a lot of kind of not necessarily anti-American, but there's a lot of, like, I guess you'd call it very low-key, not resentment, but kind of annoyance that the Americans kind of swooped in, and, you know, they absolutely helped and they were vital and all that sort of thing, but they were like, oh yeah, this is, you know, America's fighting. It's like, well, to be fair, we were fighting it for nearly 3 years. You know, at least two, nearly 3 years before you guys kind of chose to get involved. And we did it for kind of not necessarily more altruistic reasons, because, you know, there's never an altruistic reason to really go to war. But, you know, like Brandon said, it took an attack on US soil to instigate this. They didn't enter for kind of moral reasons. They didn't think, oh, well, we need to enter because... you know, it's,
we should help,
well, to help our neighbor or the wider world, or, you know, our allies, or, you know, that sort of thing. They were like, no, 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 we're staying neutral, that sort of thing. And it wasn't until they were attacked they kind of went, oh, okay, in both world wars we have been active, kind of, okay, yeah, right, we're gonna step in and try and help out and that sort of thing. And I'm not, in no way am I saying that's 100% of the truth, because I honestly don't know a huge amount about it. You know, we get taught it during our high school, but we really focus, it's quite worrying, we really focus on the development of Nazi Germany, for example, and we don't really know kind of like what caused the UK to step in, what caused our territories and all that sort of stuff to step in. So it's faithful. I agree with Brandon's sense of, you know, it's not all this kind of American, ooh yeah, you know, heck yeah, kind of spirit and mentality to it. That it kind of grates, because a lot of it is kind of like, yeah, you didn't, you know, World War II might have been kind of like your biggest victory and one of your greatest losses, everything, but you weren't really there for the whole thing. You kind of stepped in halfway and really strongly helped, and there's no denying that, but there is still quite a lot of, particularly leading up to, you know, leading up, it was, well, the Americans are getting involved, and then it was once they got involved, it was like they kind of took over. It's like, if you look at, I mean, a couple of examples I think of, so you've got A Matter of Life and Death, which is a classic 1940s kind of comedy drama. If you've not seen it, I heartily recommend it. It'll be one of the best films you've ever seen. But it is about an English pilot who falls in love with an American radio operator. It does touch on that, the whole thing of, like, you know, Yanks and Limeys, and we're all in it together, but it's still quite tense and quite weird, and a lot of culture clash, that sort of thing. And then you look at a film like Mrs. Miniver, which is about a woman who sees her children go off to war and then volunteers with the war effort. And it's very, it's quite dark in places. It's quite bittersweet and about the effect on the UK. And there is quite a bit of anti-American sentiment in it. Not because they're helping us, but because it's like, you know, we've had hundreds of thousands die while you played neutral. And now your place has been affected. You didn't step in and help. So... I thought it was an interesting thing to view, particularly during, after the plane crash, when we do have that bit where the American captain says, well, listen, we're happy to pick you up, or that sort of thing, but you can't broadcast from the ship, right, because right. We have to maintain a state of neutrality. So, mm-hmm.
And again, like, our knowledge on World War II, like, we'll freely admit, it's we're not experts on it. We've got superficial knowledge. You know, we don't have an American to talk about their point of view on how this movie...
No, that's fair, yeah, as well.
Right? So, like, this is just our discussion on this, and it stems from Hitchcock being persecuted for having left Europe, and I do believe that this is a very patriotic film.
Yes.
For all of it, because you've got Europeans fighting in this, right? You've got Americans, and he's... I believe that this is a patriotic film that he has made, and that's where this discussion has stemmed from. So again, we're not out to offend anybody, we're not out to upset anybody. This is just where our natural discussion has gone, and we do not claim to be scholars on World War II.
No, so. No. None of us were there, none of us went through it. Yeah, it's all super subjective, so please don't, like, yell at us.
Right. Hey guys, sorry to get you off the railroad track. You mentioned earlier in today's podcast about the connection to Foreign Correspondent and The Lady Vanishes. Mm-hmm. I just found here Hitchcock talking to Truffaut. The picture was pure fantasy. As you know, in my fantasies, plausibility is not allowed to rear its ugly head. In Foreign Correspondent, you have the masculine counterpart of the old lady of The Lady Vanishes. Here is a secret in the possession of an elderly gentleman. So you guys, the two of you, picked up on something that Hitchcock himself said in interview. So it really isn't that much, you know, it's basically true that these films have a connection in that they share a character with a similar part
They're
of the
like
film.
A mirror to each other.
So are they connected? Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Move over, Hitchcock. Metalla's on his way.
Yeah. In 40 years from now, there'll be The Films of Brandon Mutella, a podcast in cyber reality.
Instead of the da-da-da-da-da-da-da, we'll have the Bob and Doug McKenzie theme as my thing.
Chris, you have to learn that song.
I have no idea what you're talking about. I'm delighted that you're delighted, but I have no idea what you're saying.
Welcome to the Great White North, eh?
Eh?
My name's Bob, and this is my brother Doug.
And some back bacon, and
some
yeah. Oh, it's Canadian. Okay, that's fine. Beer. I thought it was being really dumb. I'm like, oh no, it's Canadian, eh? So
it's a Bob and Doug thing from SCTV back in the day.
You're such a hoser, you know, Chris.
Yeah. Oh, I've seen a clip. It's on YouTube. Yes.
Where's your?
Okay.
He ain't wearing no toque.
Oh God.
No, we gotta send him a toque.
Let's talk about the plane.
Let's talk about the plane crash. What a stunning... I've seen going around Facebook, there's been a clip of like a CGI representation of how this stunt was done. So what they did was they filmed and sped up the footage of a plane flying down towards the water and then like pulling out at the last second, right? So they filmed that at a high speed. They created a set of a plane. They projected that water footage on a wall so that the two pilots were like looking out this fake window and they would see the projection image of the water. And then there was two like slides filled with buckets of water at the top. And at the last second, as the footage was running out, the water was like there was a door that was open and the water came down this slide and busted through the paper that the water was being projected onto and then flooded the set. So that's how they did the shot. And they did it apparently six times or else they 'cause six pieces of paper were built to be able to project that on. I don't know if they used all six, but they were intending six takes of this. But then as the set was being like sunk and flooded, right, you notice that one shot where they're getting really close to the roof, right? The camera's kind of looking down and you can see the roof and they're going to get drowned. That top was also a paper top to the plane. So as they got right to the top, they could just rip through without having to worry about drowning and whatnot, right? And so they just cut the footage a little bit early. But that sequence is really, really intense and powerful as well. And a wonderful climax with them going on the wing of the plane at the end. As it crashed in the water, and then worrying about having too much people on there and having the plane wing sink. So, what's his face? Bad dude jumps off and kills himself.
That, people talk about the climax of this film, and it was an exciting ending. Mm-hmm. And there's a little bits of humor. The one woman, we're watching them interact on the plane, all our main characters back and forth, and then we realize that, there's another 20, 30 passengers on the plane that show up once the crash is happening. And that one woman runs through the doorway. She's like, I shall be speaking to the, the ambassador with my complaints. Boom. Bullet. Shot. Dead. There's so much for your complaint. But it's a very fast-moving and very entertaining climax. But like you were saying, these were, there's nothing digital happening here. This was real world filmmaking.
Yeah.
And tanks of water and actors being thrown around, and they were actually quite at risk, like, of the amount of water they were dealing with. So again, like, they're really going out of their way to sacrifice for the art of the film.
Yeah. And honestly, I would rather have something like this than CG any day. Like, yeah, fine, when they show the outside of the plane, you can see the strings on the plane that are holding it up and whatnot. Like, none of that bothers me, knowing how much effort they put in to make this, because that crash sequence is so stunning.
Yeah.
Like, holy smokes, it's just amazing.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's weird that we're talking about The Lady Vanishes, because I was thinking, oh, well, it's almost akin to the big shootout at the end. And while I still prefer The Lady Vanishes to this, I think this is the best sequence that I've seen in a Hitchcock movie, chronologically as we've gone through them, because it's just, it's kind of, it, you know, it's the big emotional climax, and it's the big kind of real beats happen. And it's funny that Tom mentions that bit, you know, with the woman, she's like, I'm going to complain to the British consulate and go through, and then she gets gunned down, and I'm like, it's funny, but good lord, is it dark.
I think we've pretty much exhausted the discussion on the film here. You know, like, it's outstanding. Go see it. It's really good. And we are not scholars on World War II. But, Tom, did you have any final thoughts on the film itself?
It's a good film. It's an example of an old film from the 40s that Hitchcock has produced that has merit. It has legs. It's still entertaining today. It's still interesting. Mm-hmm. And don't be afraid of the world history. It's got comedy in it. It's got intrigue. It's got adventure. And it's highly recommended.
Mm-hmm. Chris?
Yeah, as is becoming recently apparent as we go through these films, it is wonderful to see how many of them still hold up, you know, 70-odd years later. In fact, you know, it'll be
almost 80.
It'll be 80 next year.
This one's almost 80, yeah.
It has long since got its bus pass as a film. But what I love about this one in particular is, you know, like you said, you know, we're not scholars on World War II or anything, but I think you could put this in front of someone of any age or that sort of thing, and they would not only instantly get it, but they'd be entertained and they would learn through that. It's a little bit of a Trojan horse where you think you're getting, okay, it's a spy thriller, it's, you know, oh, it's entertaining and there's comedy and that sort of thing, but you do learn quite a lot about what people were going through at the time in a way that is very specific to, you know, the UK and Europe and that sort of thing. But I think it's, you know, incredibly well done. It's very interesting from a singular perspective. Like you guys have said, it's very illuminated and rousing, and the epilogue, which is basically our two leads are broadcasting out as London is mm-hmm. bombed, and they probably make it, but it's, you know, darkness fades as the lights go out and that sort of thing, but they're still broadcasting. It's that kind of what they would call the Dunkirk spirit, you know, in about 6 years after the film. But yeah, I just think it's so well done. It's so entertaining. I really wasn't expecting anything with this. I kind of thought, oh, okay, it's a war film, it'll be fine. And then I'm already kind of planning to rewatch this.
This a first time watch for you guys?
Yeah, I'd heard of it. I'd never seen it.
Tom,
I've seen this. We showed it at one of my Hitchcock marathon parties at my house, mm-hmm. but it was funny because we showed it by mistake. Anyway. But it was, I've seen it before.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
But no, for me, it has the ultimate seal, which is that I described it to my dad, who really loves war films, and he was like, why have I not seen this? And I'm like, listen, oh, wow. This is what we're going to do. And I'm going to make him watch it with the version that was provided to us. And yeah, I'm excited to watch it again.
Awesome, yeah. I get a question for you guys now. So this was nominated for Best Picture along with Rebecca. Mm. Rebecca won. Which one do you guys like better?
Oh, I still prefer Rebecca, but it's such a slim margin for me.
Mm-hmm. Tom?
Can I let you guys in on a secret?
You didn't watch Rebecca, did you?
Well, I was. That was my day off. Oh, my God. I was sick
You were like, you can't make him do homework when he was sick.
I'll watch it later. I'll get back to you.
It's worth it. It's a good film.
I failed you.
I think Rebecca's better myself, yeah. too. Like, you know, like between the two, I think Rebecca is the better picture. Yeah. So, how many secret clauses would you give this out of five, Chris?
Ooh. I was trying to think of a thing, but you've already given one. Yeah, 4.5 secret clauses or 4.5 broken windows that you have to throw luggage through in order to get out of a sinking plane.
Tom?
I'm giving it 4 out of 5 bowler hats lost in the wind.
4 out of 5? Ooh. I gave it 4.5, yeah. Like, I gave Rebecca 5, but I'd give this 4.5 secret clauses. Yeah. So this movie's really good. A couple little things hung up for me. Like that secret clause really does... I'm like, that just does not make any sense. If one of those guys trips and breaks an ankle and then, like, breaks a hip and dies, like, you know, he's old enough, he could break a hip. He breaks his hip, he's dead, and then this clause doesn't mean anything.
He breaks his hip and dies. It's not set in the Middle Ages. Oh, well, he's broken his leg. Right, get the death hammer to knock on his head just to kill him. Oh, God.
Yeah, exactly. Anyways, I am not looking forward to our next movie.
What is our next film?
Oh.
Mr. and Mrs. Smith, and it's a screwball comedy, if I remember correctly.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. There's a couple of
But our viewers, our listeners should look forward to it.
Yeah,
they
should.
Be excited. And they should keep following our show on Facebook and Twitter and all our social media.
Yeah.
And keep giving the feedback, keep making comments.
If nothing else, it'll be super entertaining to listen to us hate it, so...
Oh, I think you guys are going to love it. Because you guys like the screwball comedy of the 39 Steps, and I didn't like it that much, right? That part of it. So, yeah. I don't know. And Tom, you love Trouble with Harry.
There you go.
Right? In general, I don't.
In the real world, I'm a comedy fan. I like comedy. I like comedians. You know, I'm not really into sports and hockey and whatever. But, no, the comedy stuff for me is valuable. And Hitchcock... has a bit of a talent for it occasionally, so we'll find out in our next episode of Good Evening.
And until then, we'd like to thank the Fandom Podcast Network for hosting our show. We have our own independent feed, but we are also, as always, associated with them. We love the guys at Fandom Pod Network. You can find them on Twitter at Fanpod Network. Don't forget to check out our good friends Annie and Catherine and their show Good Evening and Alfred Hitchcock Presents podcast. I'm having a great time following along. I'm watching the show for my first time and listening to their episode discussion. They just finished up a great series where they focused on an actress, Phyllis Thaxter, who appeared in a bunch of Alfred Hitchcock Presents episode, and that was a lot of fun because Phyllis Thaxter was in a lot of great episodes of that show. So be sure to check them out. Thanks so much to Jason Cullimore for creating our wonderful theme song. We just absolutely love it. And it's October 27th. This episode is going to be released on November 1st. Which is the release of Terminator Dark Fate here in North America. And I'm actually going to go see Terminator Dark Fate with Jason Cullimore, so it's going to be cool.
It's
So I'll be right seeing on. It with him tonight.
It's good. My dad, his company worked on the production, and they saw it, and it's really good.
Awesome. It's apparently released in England already, though.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we got it last week, I think. Because we had Arnie and Linda Hamilton promoting it, so.
Mm-hmm. Wow. You can find us on Twitter at Good Evening Pod. You can find us on Facebook, Good Evening Podcast on Facebook. Just give us a search. Give us a like. We would love it if you guys could give us a rating and review on social media. You share our tweets and things like that. That really helps us get out there and helps people find the show. That's really the best thing you can do to support us is give us a like, give us a review, help people find the show. Because we just want more people to listen to us gab and talk and whatnot. On topics we know nothing about, like World War II. So, anywho. Well, that's all we got for you this time. I think we covered everything. So until next time, good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Thank you for listening to Good Evening and Alfred Hitchcock Podcast. We're currently on intermission. Yeah. Please visit the lobby and partake of a gourmet hot dog and a box of popcorn.
Yeah. We're at the movies. It's an intermission. Pay for overpriced ice cream that you don't even like, that you wouldn't pay for in a store.
The big thing now in theaters in Regina is it's like $5 for a super huge Coke cup. You got to go pour your own Coke. They give you 30 flavors, but you got to go pour it yourself. And then you're not allowed to have a free refill. And it's like, I'm paying $5 or $6 for a liter of pop. Hi. I want 3 refills. I'm going to come back tomorrow morning. Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Ezri, and I am 6. I just wanted to say hi.
Can you get up close to the microphone and tell us the name? Can you tell us what the name of the podcast is?
The podcast?
What's the name of our podcast?
I didn't watch it, but can I tell you my name?
Sure. Absolutely.
My name's Ezri.
Can you repeat after me and say you're listening to Good Evening and Alfred Hitchcock Podcast?
Yes.
Go ahead and say that really loud, close up to the mic. Good evening. You're listening to Good Evening and Alfred Hitchcock Podcast.
I want to say that.
Say that.
It's long. I don't want to.
Well, what do you want to say?
Just say good evening.
Good evening.
There we go.
That say is good evening.
Fantastic, Ezri.
Say good evening and Alfred Hitchcock Podcast.
No.
Okay. You don't have to.
She's done a great job already. Like,
do you have you watched a Hitchcock film with your dad?
No.
What kind of films do you like to watch? Do you watch TV?
Yeah.
What's your favorite TV show?
Oh, there's a show, but we're not watching it right now. It's called Teen Titans.
We'll have to check that out. Is there a favorite episode that you like, or what do you like about the show?
Okay, you go upstairs now. Say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Good evening. Thank you for saying hi.
Upstairs. I'm almost done, okay?
All right. Bye, Ezri.